Okay, so yeah, as I was saying before, this is the same slide I used from the talk a couple of years ago on user interface design. And so what this talk looks at is the psychological background behind why people have problems dealing with security user interfaces. So this is a comment from developers saying that basically users are idiots, it's not our fault, there's nothing we can do about this. So the way this works is, if you're a geek, you define rational to be the way I want users to behave, and therefore by definition, any behavior other than that is irrational. So we've got the field of psychology, which provides a huge amount of insight into why users actually behave in this supposedly irrational manner. So if you look at how users make decisions in front of, not just in front of a security dialogue, but pretty much any decisions at all, there was a traditional model for this called the economic decision-making model. And it goes back to at least game theory from the 1940s. And it assumes that you've got this optimal course of action and you will take a particular series of steps to achieve this optimal course of action. It's kind of complicated. So it's something called subjective expected utility theory, which is, or more commonly, economic decision making. I won't go through all the details here. I've got a simple code-based explanation of this. So basically the way this theory works, the way that humans are assumed to make decisions, is that for each possible alternative in a series of decisions, you evaluate the consequences of making that decision. So it's not just the immediate consequences, but you recursively dig down to all the possible carry-on effects and the things that can happen because of that. You assign probabilities to all of these possible effects. You then multiply this out by the weighting of the value of the effect, and you take the one with the highest value, thus subjective expected utility theory, the one with the greatest utility to you. Here's an example of this. This is a certificate dialogue from a previous version of Firefox, but this is a great illustration of something that has been not deliberately but accidentally designed to work with the subjective expected utility theory way of making decisions. So you go to a website and you get this huge bunch of options that you need to use to make your decision. And the final outcomes of this are accept the certificate, accept it once, or don't accept it. So let's look at just one single example of this. There's a possibility that a server's been misconfigured. So in order to use this economic decision-making model to find this out, you've got to evaluate things like the competence of the remote systems administrator, and not just the immediate competence, but let's say recursively, okay, was this admin on duty, or was it some intern who actually did this site? The chances of made an error, the chances of a software bug, there's a huge number of possible things. And then, again, from the theoretical model, you then assign probabilities to each of these things. You assign weights to other factors. So, for example, the risk of your credit card being phished, the risk of identity theft. You've got mitigating factors like credit card consumer protection measures. Things like if you're buying a birthday present, then you probably definitely do want to buy this birthday present because you will experience considerable amounts of grief if you don't. So it's this really long, tedious evaluation process. Finally, you plug this into the formula, do the maths, and you take the one with the highest probability, and that's how you make your decision. Absolutely no one thinks like this. Now, in response to this dialogue, nobody handles a dialogue like that. And there have been attempts to patch this. For example, there's something called stopping rules. So the idea is instead of recursively iterating through all these complex decision processes, you simply stop when it doesn't make any sense to continue. Problem is, stopping rules don't work. I mean, you know, if stopping rules did work, then you wouldn't be here. You'd be next door in the casino applying the stopping rule, stop playing just before you start losing. These things basically don't work. So that's the theory, and that's how typically, user interface isn't deliberately designed for this, but it kind of accidentally ends up assuming that users think like this, but they absolutely do not think like that. There are two ways to determining how users actually think. The first one is empirical evaluation. So you get some users, you study them, you see how they make decisions. The other one is conceptual modeling. You try and build a theoretical model to match how users actually make their decisions. Empirical evaluation was done by the US Department of Defense when they looked at research into battlefield decision making. There's a bunch of books, including things like the Psychology of Military Incompetence, on really bad military decision making. And so they wanted to look at this. They got some psychologists to look at this to find out how people make decisions in practice on the battlefield. And they found that people don't compare all the options. They don't even compare, let's say the top two options. They simply take the first thing that appears to work, go with that. If that doesn't work, they take the next thing that appears to work and go with that. So, and there's a field of psychology called evolutionary psychology, which tries to explain various psychological phenomena based on sort of evolutionary ideas. And the neat explanation for this is basically if you're a monkey and a lion turns up in front of you, you run up the first tree you find because it's better to be wrong than to be eaten. This is called the singular evaluation model. And it's used under basically serious conditions. If you're under pressure, which occurs on the battlefield, also in front of a computer, you want to do your job, the stupid dialogue pops up. You're immediately, this causes stress, you're under pressure. And so your decision maker's making is influenced by that. When you've got dynamic conditions, when you've got ill-defined goals, you know, you could click on this or click on that. You don't really know what's going to happen in either case. So that was one view. Let's look at what users actually do. Other researchers tried to build a conceptual model of how this decision-making process works. So the thing with why these simple heuristics, simply, you know, this looks good, I'll go with this immediately without thinking about the others, is that it's very, very difficult to get feedback from these complex decision-making processes. You've got something called diffusive reinforcement where you make a good decision, you make a bad decision. It's not immediately obvious whether this is a good or a bad decision. And that's why you get systems for things like gambling and for stock trading and stuff like that, because people like to think they're following some scientific method rather than just guessing. So in the case of gambling-based decision-making outside in the casino, you know, you put in your money, you press a button, you immediately get positive or negative feedback. This worked, this didn't work. With internet security, you don't get any feedback at all, or at least if a dialogue pops up and blocks what you want to do, and you click go away or okay or go to the site or whatever, you immediately get positive feedback. The annoying dialogue's gone away. You never ever get any negative feedback. You don't know whether, you know, in 6 months' time your credit card might have some mysterious charges appear on it, but there's no immediate feedback. Therefore, there's no way to learn from the decision-making process to improve your future decision-making. And so the result of this is kind of obvious. You know, any action on the internet that doesn't immediately trigger negative feedback appears to be positive, and therefore people click away warning dialogues. So I mentioned, you know, the problems of emotion. So any kind of emotion, not just job stress, but any kind of emotion leads to very poor decision making. There was some great, in the psychological literature, there's some great experiments that people have done in the 1950s and 1960s. This particular one, which was done on soldiers, you probably couldn't do now because of the human factors, limits on what you can do to humans in experiments. But what they did is they took a bunch of soldiers, put them in an airplane, and these guys had been trained to safely exit an airplane. And so they accidentally left the intercom on from the cockpit, and they had this rehearsed conversation from the pilot saying the plane's about to crash and we're all going to die. So these soldiers who had been trained in this performed really, really badly because of the influence of stress on their decision-making process. They performed really badly in exiting the plane safely, whereas soldiers who weren't exposed to this external influence causing stress performed relatively well. People exploit this, like stage magicians, for example. They know if they want to do a particular trick and, let's say, make an item disappear, they know they can predict how humans will think. And so they basically exploit this and do an active penetration attack on the human decision-making process to bypass this and do something in an unexpected way. So the thing is, you'd think this is a bug. It's not actually a bug. It's a feature. This is what makes humans function. There is something called the cocktail party phenomenon, the ability to pick out a single conversation or interpret a single conversation in a crowded room full of conversations. In fact, the entire human sensory system is based on taking huge amounts of input and filtering more and more and more of it out to get the one particular thing that you're interested in. So this is actually necessary in order to make humans function. If you couldn't take these shortcuts, you basically wouldn't be able to get anything done. In AI, it's called the frame problem. How can you frame a problem in such a way that it's actually solvable? There is, in problem-solving theory, it's called analysis paralysis. So there's a bunch of different fields that have run into exactly the same thing. So obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD, there are a bunch of theories about what causes this, but one of the theories is that, you know, if you've got humans with overly reductionist minds, they become trapped in all these possible implications, which causes anxiety, and so OCD is a way of dealing with the anxiety that results from this overload of input, an overload of stimulus, and an inability to form decisions based on that. Some of this does actually get back into computer security. So one of the things that researchers have found with this is that they've gone to people, sat them down in front of browsers and said, we're going to take you to some safe sites and some possible phishing sites. And we want you, instead of just clicking OK, we want you to carefully analyze these sites to see whether you consider them safe or not. And the result of this is they had to abort the experiment. There's a great, the write-up basically says that, you know, users spent absurd amounts of time. They ran into this analysis paralysis problem. They spent absurd amounts of time trying to figure out whether the site was legitimate or not. And what happened is the false positive rate went up, but the actual phishing site detection rate didn't go up by much at all. So all it did was it basically paralyzed them without providing any useful effect. The scary thing about this is, you know, this is best practice advice. We tell people, when you go to a website, carefully examine everything to make sure that it's valid. But in fact, it doesn't actually help. There is one very small class of people who, so in the, all of these, the psychological phenomena that I'll be covering, there are always a small class of people who have, who use these, the supposedly optimal way of doing things, or the way that, let's say, geeks would want people to behave. It's either people with brain damage or people with psychiatric disorders. So here's an example. There is a class of people who do use this SEU model for decision making, and that's people who have sustained damage to the frontal lobes of the brain. If this procedure is performed medically, it's called a lobotomy. So basically, lobotomy patients make decisions like this. There's a great write-up by a neurology professor where this is a very short excerpt from the whole thing. It's a considerably long description of this guy. So he had a patient in, and he was going to come here to come back the next week to see him. And he asked him, do you want to come back on Tuesday or Thursday? And there's this amazing sort of description of what this guy then did. He sort of pulled out this notebook and spent about half an hour sitting there going through all the implications of whether he wanted to come back on Tuesday or Thursday. And this was analysis paralysis. So eventually he sort of took this guy and said, you're coming back on Tuesday. And the guy said, yep, fine, that's good enough. So, you know, that's an example of what happens when people do use this economic decision-making model. They're unable to function anymore. There's an extreme case of this, something called somatizing catatonic conversion, where, as the term catatonic implies, you pretty much completely shut down. You can't function anymore because you're overwhelmed by the decision-making problem. So you'd think that this was really bad, that, you know, sort of saying, I'm going to choose this rather than carefully thinking about it would be really bad. So there's some, within the last 5 to 10 years, a bunch of researchers have actually looked at this to see whether this is actually leads to good or bad decision making. And they've looked at a whole bunch of things. So they've given people a list of information and said, you know, choose the best city to live in, estimate the high school dropout rates, that sort of thing. Here's a particular example. This is for house prices. Estimate the house prices in a typical city. And so they gave them information such as the property taxes, number of bathrooms, number of bedrooms, property size, all sorts of information. And they said, make a decision, make an estimate of house prices based on all this input. Here's an example of how heuristic reasoning works. I assume most of the people here would be from the US. So quick question. Does Munich have a larger population than Dortmund? Now, most people in response to that will say Munich without even knowing why. They'll just instantly pick Munich. Now, if you think about this, the logic behind this is, most people will have heard of Munich. Not so many people will have heard of Dortmund. So, and Munich, if it's better known, chances are it's a larger city. Therefore, it's going to be a larger city. And in Munich's case, having a large beer fest probably doesn't hurt either. The thing about this is, you don't think about why you've come to this conclusion. You just pick Munich, and you're correct in this case. So what happened was the researchers took the simple heuristics, simply, you know, pick this one, done by humans, versus this really complicated multiple linear regression, which they did in software. And they found that it was only slightly better than the basic human decision-making process of, I'm going to pick this one because it looks good to me. So they thought, this can't be right. So they hired independent programming teams in Germany and the US to replicate this, and they published all the data, and other people also replicated this. So this wasn't some sort of error in the statistics or something. Multiple regression was only slightly better than simply, you know, choosing the one that seemed like the best one. Possible reason for this is that you have a problem with linear regression called overfitting. So you've got this huge amount of input, and you assume that every single input variable is significant. And so basically, this is from statistics. So you've got this overfitting problem where it overadapts itself to the input you get. And so they confirmed this. They took the training data set and then said, here is some new data not in the training data set. And now humans performed much, much better than this multiple linear regression because it had overfitted itself to the training data and wasn't able to adapt to new data. So this isn't, you know, this isn't a bug. It's actually a feature. Human decision-making performs relatively well in conditions like this. And there's some more examples. Some people used a Bayesian network. And again, I mean, the Bayesian network is kind of the ultimate Bayesian decision-making system. And yet it performed only slightly better than humans saying, this looks good to me, I'll take that. So there's consequences of this. You've got this, you know, sort of simple, straightforward, I'll do this decision-making process. The result of making a decision is that you've now got an action. And there are two different types of actions, or at least you can distinguish between two different types of action. One of them is a controlled process. You sit there, you carefully think about everything you're going to do, and then you take that action. The other one is an automatic process. Automatic processes are pretty much free. The thing is, you're acting on autopilot. Once you get the appropriate stimulus, you take that action, and there's almost no control over it. You can't prevent yourself from doing this. An example being novice drivers versus experienced drivers. You may have experienced this. If you're driving into work, you leave home and you get into work, You can't remember anything that you did between leaving home and getting into work. You carried out some incredibly complicated interactions with other drivers, stopping at lights, avoiding cars, and so on and so forth. You don't remember any of it because it's an automatic process. And this is the reason why people click away warnings without even knowing about it. And the thing about this is, it really is subconscious processing. The nature of consciousness would be a 3-hour talk by itself. But, researchers have done functional magnetic resonance imaging of people's minds as they carry out these unconscious processes. And it really is totally unconscious. It just happens on autopilot. You can't avoid this. You can't get rid of it. So that's one of the things that Microsoft found out with their automatic update system. If you run Windows, you'll notice that with XP Service Pack 2, they effectively turned it into nagware, so that instead of clicking it away, it would keep coming back again and again and again to remind you that you needed to reboot your machine. And the reason for that was, there's a great log from Microsoft Tech Support, which I didn't want to put all the quotes in here because it's pages and pages of these things, but it's basically comments from users saying, I didn't even know this was happening. I didn't know I was doing this. And in particular, if you've got a machine that's infected with adware, you've got a constant string of pop-ups, and you unconsciously swat these things away without even thinking about it. And the Windows update thing is just another pop-up that you swat away without even being aware that you're doing it. And that's why they turned it into an adware, because they found these machines had no updates applied. They had all these updates sitting there waiting to be installed, but the machine wasn't rebooted because users were getting rid of the update dialogue without even knowing about it. And this isn't just a computer security issue. It occurs in the real world as well. There's some neat failure modes in this. Like the British trains have, for about 100-odd years in various forms, had something called the automatic warning system, which is you've got various danger signals. So if you go past a danger signal, then it triggers this indicator inside at the front of the train, and the driver then has 3 seconds to cancel that indicator. So the idea behind this is if you go through a danger signal and the driver's dead or something, if they don't cancel the indicator within 3 seconds, the train is stopped automatically. So it's a fail-safe system. The problem with this was that it had there are 4 different levels of indicators on the lights by the side of the track. There's green, yellow, double yellow, and red. However, the warning system only had 2 indication states, which was green and not green. So every time the driver went through a simple warning, which could quite safely be ignored, they got this indicator that they had to cancel. And so they became habituated into automatically cancelling any kind of warning that turned up with this automatic warning system. So the result of this was that they, whenever they got a genuine warning, they would swat it away without even thinking about it. Again, it was an automatic process. They weren't even aware that they were doing it. The scary thing is there's actually a name for this. It's signal passed at danger, or SPAD. And, you've got to wonder, if you've got a usability defect in your system that's so serious that it has its own name, then that should be kind of a warning sign that maybe you need to reconsider this. There's another one which it takes a while to explain. It's called Ding Ding and Away, where the guard would ring a bell twice to tell the engine driver that it was safe, that as far as the guard was concerned, the engine could leave the station. It didn't mean that from the engine driver's point of view, it was safe to leave. It said, I don't object to you leaving. The problem with what actually happened, I mean, this is classical Pavlovian conditioning. They even used a bell. The guard would listen for the 2 rings on the bell and then pull out of the station without doing any more checking. And again, this has its own name, Ding Ding, in a way, because these things have been happening for a long time. And again, that should be kind of an indicator that you may want to fix the system if it's got its own name. So there's some other problems involved in this. Something called confirmation bias. Humans are really bad at generating testable hypotheses. If you've got a particular series of events, they'll form a hypothesis about something, and then they'll look for facts to confirm this rather than to disprove it. So here's an example of this in practice. How do you check whether a website's valid? Well, you enter your username and password, and if it lets you in, then it's obviously a legitimate website because it knows your username and password. The thing about, people laugh at this. The thing is, if the security geeks had designed the security mechanisms properly, where you have mutual cryptographic authentication of client and server, the server has to authenticate itself to the user at the same time, then this would actually be a valid way of thinking of doing it. So from the user's point of view, this is reasonable thinking. In this case, the technology has actually failed the users. So the U.S. Navy, for example, after the accidental shoot down of an Iranian airliner, introduced something called the step cycle, which is basically a way of going through all the possible consequences in a decision-making process. So it's actually, if you read this, the report of the shoot down, it was kind of interesting. There was a civilian airport that was also used for military aircraft. And the assumption was that this aircraft that was attacking them, this aircraft that had taken off from this airport was about to attack them. And so every step of the decision-making cycle, there were two options, one of which is it's a civilian aircraft, the other one was it's a military aircraft. Because they'd assumed from the outset it was a military aircraft, they always took the decision branch that said it's a military aircraft. And at the end of this long tree of decisions, they actually had this thing saying we're about to be attacked by a military aircraft. Whereas if they'd taken the alternate path, it would have said it's a civilian airliner that's going to fly overhead and miss us completely. There's a whole bunch of other biases. There's a really nasty one called blind spot bias, which means that you can't actually see your own biases. So even if you have all these biases, you can't detect that you have them. There's a really good book by the CIA called The Psychology of Intelligence Analyses, which was intended to defeat this kind of bias thing. So one of the problems the CIA had was something, own-side bias, which is basically everyone thinks like us. And that led to decisions like saying, we're going to send a hit squad out to assassinate this foreign politician and everyone will agree with us because everyone thinks like us. So the reason for publishing this book was for CIA analysts to be able to see that, maybe everyone doesn't think like us. So one of the problems with this projection bias is that this has hit a lot of computer security implementations. For example, SSH. One of the neat things with SSH is that it assumes that once you've entered your username and password, then after that, you wouldn't have any malicious intent. And so it does, a lot of implementations do very little checking after that point because they assume that you're on your side. So, the assumption is an attacker would never dream of authenticating themselves and only then sending us bad packets. And there's many, many examples of this. Unix access control. You check security on the first access to a file. After that, you're one of the good guys, so we'll let you through. Signed ActiveX controls, the confused deputy problem. There's lots and lots and lots of examples of this, like Solaris AutoMount D. Only root could possibly be sending us anything, and we can trust root, therefore we don't have to do any checking. If you were at the talk last year on hacking internet kiosks, this is a great example of this projection bias. So the assumption normally is that the goals of the computer owner and the computer user are identical. In internet kiosks, this doesn't happen anymore. The computer user may be completely hostile to the computer owner. And so typically the response to, let's say, some potential malware is you pop up a dialogue saying, this may be malware, are you sure you want to run it? So, if you've got someone who wants to hack an internet kiosk and you pop up a message saying, do you want to run rootkit.exe? Yeah, absolutely. So that's an example of projection bias in practice. I'll skip some of this. So there's users are able to rationalize away all sorts of problems. And the field of rationality is sort of incredibly complicated, and depending on which author you read, there's all sorts of different approaches to this. So I'll skip some of this. So one example that's occasionally, you may have seen this in pop psychology programs, is something called the Forer effect, where people will adjust the statistics or adjust what they hear in order to adapt it to their personal beliefs. So this is a classic experiment from the 1950s. A guy gave a bunch of students these supposedly personalized horoscopes and asked them to rate how accurate this horoscope was in terms of predicting, what they were really good at. So, for example, for a student, you're generally confident in what you do, but sometimes you're a bit nervous that you may be giving wrong answers in an exam. Yep, that completely applies to me. So the average rating for this horoscope was 4.26 out of 5, which is an extremely high rating. And what happened is every single student had been given exactly the same totally bland generic horoscope, and yet they all rated it as being personally applicable to them. And there's a bunch of others like, palm reader. They asked him to give exactly the opposite of what he was reading from people's palms for the following week, and people would rate him. And they rated him just as highly as when he told them, what he supposedly was reading from their palms. There's lots and lots of results like this because psychologists like messing with people, basically. But anyway, in terms of security and rationality, our brains have evolved for basically survival and reproduction, not for this obsessive scientific search for the truth. So quick and dirty techniques work reasonably well in the real world, as the earlier examples showed. They work reasonably well. So we can rationalize away almost anything. Here's some more examples. I've got the slides are on the CD, it's difficult when you do a talk like this. You want to turn it into a general pop psychology talk because there's so many weird and wonderful things about the human mind, but I'll skip some of these things. So anyway, the point is people will construct these plausible explanations for things that are in theory quite implausible. And obviously it plays straight into the hands of fishers. I mean, here's an example where humans went to a fishing site. This is, again, in a study, not an actual real fishing site. And virtually any kind of bizarre behavior that the phishing site had, they could explain away. SSLyahoo.com is a subdirectory of Yahoo. It's an outsourcing site. I've been to many other sites that only have IP addresses, and this site has an IP address only, so that's perfectly okay. The thing is, this is normal human behavior. This isn't stupidity or some sort of aberrant behavior. This is normal human behavior to reason like this. An extreme example, these are patients whose brain hemispheres have been separated. So in some cases when people have very, very severe epileptic attacks, the only way to treat that is by splitting the two brain hemispheres. It's called a corpus callosotomy, or more generally a split brain. And so what researchers have done with these split brain patients is they fed information to one brain hemisphere and then asked the other brain hemisphere why it's doing this. So they've told, let's say, the left half of the brain, get up and walk around the room. And then they've asked the right half of the brain, because different actions are controlled by different parts of the brain, so you can do this. They've said, why are you walking around the room? And one half of the brain literally had no idea, because it had been severed, why the other half of the brain was doing this. But people could always come up with explanations. I wanted to stretch my legs, I needed to go up and get a drink, something like that. So people can rationalize away pretty much anything, even when they literally have no idea why they're doing it. And some more bits and pieces. So there are lots of cases in which the brain essentially fools people into thinking things that aren't necessarily true. There's an example with human vision. So if you look at the human eyeball, you've got the sensors, and then the optic nerves, instead of coming out behind the photoreceptors, they come out the side. So they have to go through the back of the eyeball at one point, which is the blind spot. And so what happens is the brain takes information from the surrounding part of the image and essentially patches over that blind spot, so that you don't notice that you've got a blind spot in the back of each eye. Incidentally, if you're interested in annoying intelligent design advocates, cephalopods don't have this problem. So they've got a properly designed eyeball, which means that either the designer made a mistake or that humans aren't the highest life form on the planet. Birds have an even better designed visual system, so probably birds have the best designed visual system of all. There's another neat example, which I like this because it has such a neat name, confabulation across saccades. So what happens is when you're sitting there, your eyeballs are constantly making these rapid jerky movements called saccades. And it happens when you move your vision from one place to another. But even when you're sitting there apparently looking straight ahead, this is still happening. And so what happens is your brain smooths over this. So it takes the image around where you made the sudden movement, and it tells you that this is what you're seeing is continuous vision rather than having these jerky movements in the middle of this. If you've got an analog watch, you can actually see this sometimes. If you look down at your watch, you notice the second hand stops or appears to have stopped. It's called chronostasis, and then suddenly it starts moving. And what's happened there is that you've been caught in the middle of a saccade, and the brain is sort of smoothing over this and getting the last known good image, and effectively it's stretching the duration of a second because it's feeding you this previous image rather than what was actually there. The thing is, this is not a bug. This is a psychological self-defense mechanism. So psychologists have looked at people with depression, and there's this phenomenon called depressive reality. So depressed people, instead of having a sort of, it's a weird term. Depressed people don't have a overly negative grasp of reality. They have a much more realistic grasp of reality than everyone else. So basically, self-delusion is a part of good mental health. That if people who have this, people who have depression are have a more realistic view of the world. So again, it's not a bug; it's a feature. So again, let's say in theory, being geeks, okay, how can we fix this? Can we patch the human brain? So let's say, could we remove emotions from decision-making? So instead of using these irrational emotions, we'll just use cold, hard logic. So there's a part of the brain, it's part of the primitive limbic system called the amygdala, which regulates emotions. It has a bunch of very complicated functions, but one of the sort of functions that it has is regulating emotions. Some people can have damage to the amygdala, which means that effectively control over their emotions is removed. So basically they're more or less emotionless. It's kind of complicated. There's lots and lots of other interactions. So in theory you'd think, okay, damaged amygdala, no emotions, therefore you've got completely rational, logical decision making, none of this nasty emotive stuff that screws up your ability to make decisions. In practice, people with this type of brain damage are really, really bad decision makers, because once the emotion's removed, you literally don't care anymore about the decisions you're making, and therefore that leads to really, really bad decision making. So again, you've got something that looks like a bug. It is in fact a feature that's necessary in order to function effectively. Okay, so another example, this is the Simon Says problem. This is a real problem that people have. So if you're required to change your behavior in the absence of a stimulus from the game Simon Says, browser padlock is basically the immediately obvious result of this. And again, there's various experiments that people have performed that shows that humans are really, really bad at changing their behavior in the absence of a particular stimulus. People find negative information really, really difficult to process. So if you read educational psychology texts, they will specifically say, if you're teaching children, give them positive information rather than negative information. Here's an example from propositional calculus. So again, psychologists use these problems to evaluate how to phrase a particular question to improve the chances of people being able to handle it. Here's an example of a really, really difficult way to phrase things. This is phrased entirely in negative terms. Today's not Wednesday, then it's not a public holiday. Today is not a public holiday. Is today not Wednesday? This is the hardest possible way you can phrase this particular question in terms of interpreting public holidays. Now think about what a browser tells you. If the padlock is not showing, the security is not present. You couldn't make this any worse if you deliberately designed it to be like that. So there's something called inattentional blindness, and again, the phenomenon of attention is incredibly complicated, and there's about a three-hour talk in that by itself, but there's something called inattentional blindness. If you're not specifically paying attention to something, then you don't register it. And again, in this case, functional magnetic resonance imaging has shown that there really is no brain activity. If you're not paying attention to something, then there's not even subconscious recognition of it. It just isn't there. The padlock again. There's something called gorillas in our midst, which is occasionally shown on pop psychology TV programs, which shows a bunch of people playing, I think it's basketball, and they have some subjects, and they get asked to count how many times the ball has bounced. And halfway through, this guy in a gorilla suit walks onto the thing and sort of beats his chest and waves his arms and walks off again. Only 54% of users notice this guy in a gorilla suit prancing around in front of the camera because it's inattentional blindness, because they got told, you know, watch the basketball players and not check out for gorillas and other stuff. You may have encountered this on the road. If you're a driver, you're looking for cars and very occasionally pedestrians, but not much else. And so, for example, if you ride a bike on the road, you're probably aware of the fact that you're more or less invisible to cars. And that's not because people are lazy or stupid or anything like that. It's because what they're looking for is other cars. And your profile is basically not a car, therefore you're invisible to them. And again, this is not people being stupid. You are literally invisible to them. They don't register your presence. And so, yeah, obviously the padlock, and you've got various other security indicators. These are a perfect match for inattentional blindness. Users don't register them. It's not just padlocks. It's things like IE6 introduced this blue security ribbon, which no one noticed. And there's a whole bunch of other things that, yeah, people simply don't register. And here's another example. If you used Vista, particularly after it first came out, when there were lots and lots of these UAC dialogues, did anyone here know... realize the fact that these UAC dialogues have different colors depending on the circumstances? So basically, you know, people have these things popping up. As I said, it's got a lot better now, but with the initial version, you have these things popping up all the time, and most people never realize they have different colors because it's just not something you're paying attention to. So the problem with this is, sort of trying to sum this up, the geeks who build this software have very, very different thought processes than normal humans. Here's an example of brand recognition. You know, let's say a normal human goes into a store, they see a DVD player, and there's, let's say, a Philips DVD player, well-known brand, and a Kamikaze player. They'll buy the Philips because they recognize that. Geeks, on the other hand, will look at this Kamikaze player and see that it does 100 different weird video formats, and it's got an SD card reader and a USB in and all sorts of stuff like that. And they will say, yeah, it makes sense to buy this one. So for both sides, you've got a perfectly sensible, natural decision. I'll let you read that for a sec. XKCD, great online comic, and so he summed this up perfectly in this geek decision-making process. Okay. And this is exactly the thing. If you have, you know, you get completely different decision-making processes and thought processes in geeks versus normal humans. So here's another example of this. MBTI, Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, which it's kind of sold as a personality test. It's really just a way of binning people into certain Jungian personality types. It's not necessarily a personality test. But anyway, you give this to geeks, and they tend to fall into a particular personality types. The TJ personality types, and in particular security geeks tend to be int J's and to a lesser extent int P's. This is just a particular classification system, so the details aren't that important. The point of this is, in terms of the let's say relatively broad TJ personality types, only 7% of the population actually thinks like this. So if you're a geek building computer security software, then 93% of the population thinks very differently to the way you think. Here's a nice illustrative example of the difference between the way geeks and humans think about these things. Simple logical thing. All of Anne's children are blonde. So does it follow from this that at least some of Anne's children are blonde? And I found out, I beta tested this talk a year or two back and found out that I have to add this additional disclaimer, given that this is a geek audience. Assume that Anne has a non-zero number of children. Anyway, can I just get a show of hands? People who think this is true, that if all of Anne's children are blonde, then it's true that at least some subset of Anne's children are blonde. Pretty much. Okay, those people who don't think this is true. And those people who think this is a trick question and haven't put up their hand at all. Yeah, there's a couple. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it is true. It's in Aristotelian logic, it's subalternation, and obviously it's true. The scary thing about this is that 70% of normal humans, so non-geeks, who, when asked that question, will say that it's actually false. And, you know, in the psychological jargon, this result is robust. So if you take the same question and you can phrase it in lots and lots of different ways, not just, you know, Anne and blonde children, and take it across lots and lots of different cultures across the world, these results are consistent. So it's not something that's, you know, let's say to one specific culture or one specific ethnic group or something like that. This is a robust result. So the thing with this is the people creating the security software just think very, very differently from the people that are actually using it. So conclusion is, yeah, humans, so typical non-geek minds work very, very differently from geek minds. And so if you've got an application written, let's say, by geeks for geeks, then it's no wonder that it's going to be very difficult to use by non-geeks. And the mind works in very, very counterintuitive ways. But the thing is, these are not bugs. These are features, because in every case, if you try and defeat some of these what appear to be bugs, you get much, much worse behavior after that. And, yeah, conclusion, geeks are weird. And, yeah, psychologists can confirm geeks are weird. I've actually finished uncharacteristically early. If people are interested in more information about this, I've got a very long write-up online as a PDF. And there's no breakout session after this because it's the final talk. So I guess I've got extra time for questions. And if anyone wants to talk psychology afterwards, if you can grab me in the hallway, I'm kind of really interested in this stuff. So anyone who wants to talk psychology, you just grab me afterwards in the hallway. Until then, any questions? Finger pointing? Yeah. Hang on. Sorry, can you either come closer or find a microphone? I don't know. I'm not aware of any research into that. Sorry. The question was, do geeks respond differently to the prisoner's dilemma? I don't know of any research into that. Intuitively, I'd say that most geeks would know what the prisoner's dilemma is and therefore know how to short-circuit it, whereas normal humans won't. But I don't know of any direct research into that. Yeah. The validity of... So that sounds kind of like the empirical approach to things, as in, you know, see what users do. The material in this talk was kind of the underlying theory behind this. So... Yeah, I mean, it's a great idea. Actually measuring what users do is, unfortunately, it's done far too little. You know, you've got this problem of designing by geeks for geeks. Like, I think like this, I'm going to design a dialogue like this for other people who think exactly like me. This is going to sound very waffly and generic, but yeah, the more work like that we can get, the better, showing what users want rather than what geeks think they want. Good question. The question was, is there any security design that works really well based on our natural tendencies? Well, I mean, one example, which is totally unrelated to computers, is ignition keys on cars. Because what you're doing there is you've got a key and you use it to tell the car when to start. And the security functionality is entirely free. So that's one of the examples of security usability that works really well. As far as the user's concerned, they're just telling the car to start and the security comes for free. In terms of computer software, I'd have to think about it for a while. I mean, there's stuff out there, but simply, you know, there's such a huge amount of UI design. It's hard to sort of pull something up out of it, on demand. Yep. It's very, yeah, so there's something called the white male effect. The problem is, which I'll explain in a second. The question was, does gender affect this at all? It's very difficult to perform gender-specific studies on this to say that one gender is better or worse at this than another. It's just politically incorrect to suggest that. So it has been covered to some extent. For example, there's this thing called the white male effect, which means that white males are more likely to trust technology blindly, whereas non-white males aren't. And that is measurable, although in some cases disputed. I'm not aware of anything showing that women would be better at designing these things. On the other hand, given things like the white male effect, which shows that white males are particularly bad at doing this, I would suspect that, getting women involved in the design process would be a really good step. But as I said, I'm not aware of any research where anyone's dared to broach this topic. Yeah. Oh man, that's a long rant by itself. it's kind of shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic. The question was, how do I feel about the new Firefox user interface for certificates and stuff? That would require a long reply. So one way, if you look at this, if you go to the Mozilla developer forums and you print out the discussion that led to this change in user interface, it comes to about 100 A4 pages of people arguing over what to do. And the conclusion of this is that nobody has any idea what they can do to make PKI start working in SSL. It never reaches a conclusion. It's just we're going to make these changes, although nobody can agree on whether this is good or bad. I could do an hour-long rant about this, but it hasn't. It's not helping. It's designed by geeks for geeks. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk to people about this. Yeah. So sure. Yeah. I would say, so the question was, what's better, the UACM model under Windows or the sort of Unix/Mac-based model of Sudo, that sort of thing? I would say the thing is, if you've got a greenfields thing where you can start from scratch and say, I'm going to build this in, actually neither. There's something called CapDesk. So the problem with either, with both of these is these aren't aligned to human behavior and what humans want. As a human, I want to say I want to open this Word document without it reformatting my hard drive. And any sort of kind of ACL-based permission to that doesn't work. So there's some work done by HP Labs called CapDesk, which assigns a capability to an object. So the Word document cannot reformat your hard drive, no matter how your ACLs are set. So it basically says, here is what user behavior a user expects in terms of the behavior of a Word document. ACLs aren't well aligned to that. And UAC, again, that was based on the fact that under Windows, everyone ran as admin, and so UAC was kind of a band-aid to fix that. So it's a horrible approach, but it's probably the best you could do under the circumstances. Yeah.
What's the best interface design you've seen?
That's sort of like, what's your favorite color or favorite song? It's really hard to answer. Apple do a pretty good job. I'm overgeneralizing completely here. I'm not saying that everything they do is perfect, but in general, Apple seem to do a pretty good job of getting the user interface right. But notice I'm using Windows here to do this. No, the thing is, that's a huge that's a huge generalization. You see the particular features. Again, that would take a very long answer. It's very hard to generalize like this. I mean, we can talk about it afterwards, but it's difficult to come up with a soundbite kind of answer. I guess one more question. Yeah. Okay, so... Right. So yeah, what the bits I could hear over the shouting from outside was automated decision-making. In other words, can you create some sort of, let's say, AI or rule-driven system to make decisions on behalf of users? Something like that? Okay. That would be a really good idea. I mean, the point of most of these security dialogues is basically that it's a failure on the behalf of the programmers. They have no idea what to do anymore in this particular situation, and so they say, well, throw up a dialogue in front of the user, and then it's the user's fault. There's a book on security usability where they actually interview a developer and they say exactly this. You know, whenever there were two camps within the development process and they couldn't agree on what to do, they would throw up a dialogue in front of the user. So, yeah, in theory, it's a really good idea that humans shouldn't be forced to make all these stupid decisions. The computer should make it for them. The problem is that, you know, the reasons why humans are forced to make these decisions is because developers and programmers can't agree on what decision to make at that point. So, yeah, in theory, it's a good idea. In practice, it's hard to implement. Thank you. Okay, I guess that's it. Thank you.